So I'm Rick Hansen, and it's November 18th, right, 2015. And I want to talk tonight about what I think in many ways is really at the essence of quote-unquote Buddhist practice. And of course, the Buddha has no monopoly on, and Buddhists have no monopoly on, practices that help relieve suffering in ourselves and others, and in its place, foster and create more happiness, more love, more wisdom. And you may have encountered views of Buddhism that it's the bummer religion, right? You suffer, you die, repeat, right? You know, it has that quality to it. It's like my dad once said to me, you know, Rick, I think this Buddhism stuff's really good for miserable people. And he didn't mean it as a put down. It was like he thought he was being a really good guy. He was being generous, you know, and because he knew I was into it. And I said, but I'm happy. Like, I don't have any use for it, basically. So it has that quality to it. And I've had a reflection lately in that context I kind of want to share with you, which is, you know, the Buddha's offering, based on his own long, very intense journey of practice, was that suffering, you know, gross and subtle, was actually unnecessary. There was an inevitable amount of physical and emotional and interpersonal pain or discomfort that as biological beings who love each other and one day will be separated one way or another from everything they love, perhaps over the course of many days, many things, many beings they've loved, there will be some pain, but there need not be suffering. Suffering being a sense of tension or pressure, emotional upset, all that topspin we tend to add, drivenness, subtle forms of suffering, especially now, 2,500 years later, when we have refrigerators and Advil, right? And we're not living in such a dog-eat-dog world. But, you know, subtle forms of suffering, like a sense of unfulfillment in life, or an awkwardness with other people, or just getting a bad vibe in certain situations, or feeling like you got too much to do, or they're in too little time, or there are expectations on you you can't fulfill, a sense of always falling short subtly, disappointing others, or being less than others. These subtle forms of suffering. The Buddha was saying, you know, that's really unnecessary. Now, why would it be unnecessary? He says, because it arises due to causes. Suffering is caused. And if you eliminate the causes of suffering, you eliminate suffering as well. And in his view, the fundamental, he was locating causes of suffering fundamentally inside human psychology, which was radical for his time. It was a complete breakthrough. He was basically saying, it's something we're doing inside our heads or in the body altogether, you know, using the head as a metaphor. We're causing our suffering. Wow, that's really radical. So what are these causes that we're engaged in? And he summarized it in one word, the big umbrella term, craving, tanha, in Pali, the language of early Buddhism 2,500 years ago, thirst. The root of the word for craving is thirst. Sometimes otherwise translated as clinging, attachment. I think of it as, you know, the internal sense of must, insistence, drivenness. You could see it in, you know, zebras, mice, lizards, and monkeys, and humans as well. You know, this quality of, you know, fighting what's unpleasant, grasping after what's currently, trying to hold on to what's pleasant currently, or get some, right? That's grasping, a form of craving. And then we have all our interpersonal clingings to what's heartfelt. A lot occurring inside our own imagination, inside the simulator, as I talked about it last time, this extraordinary neurological evolutionary achievement, this capacity based on mainly midline cortical networks to just live, to be in a world of imagination, of reverie, of, you know, 2 to 10 second little mini movies, little arguments, little interactions, little what ifs, little kind of agitated attitudes toward herself. Right? That's the realm, that's the space in which often we enact craving, clinging, grasping, attachment. Okay. So that's the basic idea, right? Familiar one. I started reflecting on it. And the key question here is, well, if suffering's unnecessary, and if suffering arises, occurs in our own hearts, and crowds out, it's not just that suffering's bad, but that it crowds out love and happiness and contentment, fulfillment, feeling all right, feeling at peace. Okay? It's not just the presence of the bad, but the crowding out of the good that's problematic, and which also creates lots and lots of conflicts and entanglements with others that start having a persistence over time, right? Self-organizing, that keep lasting. So, okay, so this suffering arises due to causes. What are the causes of the causes? Why do we cling? How does craving arise in the mind-body process, this physical animal process in time? And fundamentally, in my view, and I think it's a plausible one, of course that's, I would, wouldn't I? But anyway, is that if you look at craving, fundamentally, zebras crave, lizards have their form of craving, right? Mice, monkeys, humans crave. Why do we crave? Well, craving is a drive state. It arises dependently upon an underlying sense or belief in deficit or disturbance or both. Something's wrong, something's missing. Otherwise, there'd be no basis for craving. There'd be nothing wrong. We'd already have enough. We don't need any more. There's nothing to fix. Craving's about fixing. It's about, there's a presumption of problem embedded in it. If there's no problem, there's no basis for craving. Okay. I just want to flag later on that I think it's very possible to be committed to social justice, to be passionate, to be creative, to be engaged in life, to be aspirational without tipping into the trouble of craving. So we can talk about that later. It's a big exploration. One I've personally explored a lot because it's very relevant for householders. But let's just say for the moment, kind of setting that consideration aside, go back to this matter of craving. Because in many ways, the essence of Buddhist practice is, you know, certainly as taught by the Buddha himself, is mindfulness of craving and mindfulness of its end. Continuously. Right? It's very central. So if we have then, and we can look internally, wow, embedded in my own forms of craving is some implicit presumption of something missing, deficit, not enough love, not enough popularity, not enough 5-star reviews on Amazon for my books. You know, I need more, right? Whatever, there's a not enoughness. I want more pleasure, you know, more possessions. Or a sense of imbalance, disturbance, uneasiness, anxiety often is implicit in much, much, much craving. Okay? So then the question becomes, wow, is it possible to not have that sense of deficit or disturbance in our experience? What's not that? So this is where it gets really interesting. When there isn't craving, when there isn't this underlying sense of deficit or disturbance, what is there? Happiness. And I'm going to do a little experiential practice with you, if you're up for it, in kind of three parts in a minute about this. In other words, when we don't feel disturbed, right, and instead we feel okay. And also when we don't feel an emptiness inside or a not enoughness, and instead feel a fullness, an overflowingness. Ah. In both cases, we don't just get numb. It's not just blank, right? It's not just the absence of suffering. It's the presence of well-being, contentment, you know, happiness, in a word. Right? So we have the result of no craving is happiness. But what happens, whoop, if you start with happiness? What happens if you already feel happy? In other words, if they're already happy now, in a word. In other words, if you already feel basically, in terms of a organizing framework I use of our three core needs, it's consistent with Buddhist psychology. In other words, if you feel already safe and satisfied and connected, if you already feel like you're okay, you're safe, you're all right now, and you already are feeling there's an enoughness, a gratitude, a contentment, you know, kind of a smile. And if you already feel liked and loved and loving yourself, in that moment, is there craving? I don't think so. I think in that moment, craving really falls away. Maybe there's some kind of subtle habit of craving around the periphery. We're not yet enlightened, let's say, or it's stable. But in that moment, happiness is not just the result of no craving. Happiness is the cause of no craving. It totally turns it around. Already happy now crowds out craving, which then creates happiness in the next moment in a positive kind of cycle. Wow. And then the question becomes how to stabilize that. And isn't it interesting that, so a couple things. First, my view that I'd like to offer. So imagine that, if you will, I've always wanted to do this, and I'm not sure if anyone will ever get it, because maybe I'm crazy, not because you don't get things. But so it's like this. So time now, right? This great mystery, because as I look at my watch to make sure I have enough time to do this, it's like temporally infinitely thin, but subjectively, just kind of stay with it, it's about a second and a half long. The subjective present is about a second to 2 seconds long or so. And that's probably because there are recursive neurological loops that take time for signals to propagate through in recursive circular ways, which gives this a sense of a kind of little buffer in which we live always now. So just kind of imagine now, this little buffer, like a standing wave. So I'm going to do it from this side. You know, over there's the future. Over there's the past. Right here is the standing wave. You know, like a standing wave, like a river streaming over a rock? Okay. So the pattern itself is fairly stable, constantly kind of changing, based on the inputs of the stimuli landing at the leading edge of the window of consciousness. Okay? It's like we're in a car. Time's coming this way. Hits the front edge of that window. It's about a second and a half thick. Roughly, kind of semi. So we've got the standing wave. It's a second and a half thick. And then whoop, gone. But here we are. It just keeps, we're just hanging here, right? In the standing wave. You get it? Now. It's now. Here we are now. Right? Okay, so far, so weird, but all right. This is good. Never done it like this. Okay, we're on the standing wave. You kind of zzz, right? Zzz, right? Okay. And here's the really, really cool part. The very front edge of that standing wave before, I'm going to use a technical term. Ready? 1, 2, 3. Before any shit happens. Okay? Right at that front edge. There's no problem. look closely. The stuff has happened. I'm going to do it this way in a frame that might be familiar to you. The Buddha talked about the five aggregates of consciousness. The root of the word for aggregate, skandhas, is heaps. It's like piles. So he's sorting everything into five piles. The first pile is form, physical reality, and bare sense data. Okay. Now, alongside with that one, then there's a second aggregate, which is awareness. Okay. In his view, awareness wasn't cosmic; it was caused by having basically an animal body and sense organs. But just okay. In the very beginning, we have consciousness, physical reality, and bare sense data at the leading edge of the windshield of the standing wave. Okay, so far, second and a half wide, long, right at the front end, there's some awareness. There's like an apprehending capability upon which stimuli land. In the nervous system, after about the first tenth of a second, those stimuli are starting to form into the beginnings of a conscious percept continually, right? Remember standing wave? It's still there, right? Standing wave, right there. Okay, awareness and form. And then the Buddha talked about, so we have two of the five aggregates so far, consciousness and form. Then he talked about the feeling tone, the hedonic tone of experience, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. I might add heartfelt as well, okay? Got it? So you see, as the stimuli start moving through that second and a half standing wave, the ripple starts out, it's really bare. There's no suffering in it, nor is there any craving. It's just form, it's just stimuli, it's just the beginning of sound, the beginning of pressure on the body, the beginning of a thought or emotion arising, bubbling up into consciousness. It's the first half second. There's no trouble yet. Right? Then comes the third, the feeling tone, still there. It's just, we're just animals. Stuff's unpleasant, right? Stuff's pleasant, tastes good, tastes bad, it's neutral, feels yummy to hug someone, heartfelt, whatever, okay? Then there comes perception. That's the fourth aggregate. Okay, perception just sorting it into a category. Oh, okay. Sugar, sweet, pleasant, sugar, labeling it. That's perception. Memories of eating candy. Okay, or unpleasant, sour, kind of stale, yuck. Okay, so far, no suffering. We've gotten four aggregates, no suffering yet. Okay. Right? And then what the Buddha called the volitional formations, the formations of thoughts and selfing. Self lives in the formations. In the first front, there's not much sense of self of any. It's just stuff's happening, right? But then in the second long, second and a half or so standing wave, the tail end of the standing wave, continually, time streaming through us, right? Hanging out here, the tail end comes all the trouble. The selfing, the me-ing, the owning, the strategizing, the holding on, the clinging. Okay? Isn't that kind of wild? Mm-hmm. So the closer we get to the front edge of the standing way, the less suffering there is. And I think that's why all the teachers everywhere talk about being here now, right now. You know, and they do stuff to startle us, because when you're startled, you're knocked to the front of that standing wave. And that's why, as I've talked in here, neurologically, it makes so much sense to train in the alerting aspect of attention, where you're just, something's happened and you have no idea what it is. Because knowing what it is and what to do about it and whether you like it or not and if it reminds you of your mother or not, you know, that's at the tail end of the standing wave. If you stay out of that stuff, you tend to migrate in terms of where your consciousness is stably resting, more toward the front edge of that second and a half wide standing wave, continually. Okay? So at the front edge, I want to talk about the three needs, right? At the front edge, usually, not always, but usually, it's actually true that in this moment, there's no shark chewing on your leg, no, you know, chainsaw massacre person is coming at you. I watch these like thriller actions, Fargo. Oh my God, what a dark thing. People in Minnesota are nice. I mean, my relatives come from that part of the world. But anyway, like all this weird stuff happens, but actually it just doesn't happen very often. I mean, honestly, terrible things happen, obviously recently in France, of course. But on the whole, the front edge of your moments, my moments, they're almost always basically safe. I'm basically all right. I'm not starving to death, I'm not drowning, I'm not in agonizing pain. At the front edge, I'm okay. Then I start to worry. Okay, that's later in the wave, but at the front edge, no problem. It's okay. Okay. Also at the front edge, there's a fullness because there's so much perceptual processing at that front edge. So much is happening that the brain is actually trying to filter out 99% of it, because otherwise we'd just be blown open by it all. Right? And also at that front edge, very often, is an embedded sense of connectedness with others and a kind of, it's available to us, a warm-heartedness. And then I think what happens is that Mother Nature starts lying to us, because lizards, mice, and monkeys, and humans who are just hanging out at the front edge and now, hey, it's all fine. It's all groovy. You know, they weren't very motivated to live to see the sunrise. So what Mother Nature does is she adds craving, a problem consciousness, a problem orientation. Right? Something's missing, a little murmuring of, there are threats. Don't let down your guard, there are threats out there. She adds all that stuff. Do they really love you? Do they love you as much as they ought to love you? How do you know? Right? She adds that. So if you think about it, we start from this notion that, you know, craving is what's natural, and so we had to work and struggle up the path of awakening to the Mount Everest of enlightenment to no longer be free of craving. But actually, what if craving is what's added to a perfectly fine standing wave? It's functionally effective, dog-eat-dog world, you know, keeping animals alive, but actually it's added to what's actually, in most cases, just fine already. Wow, think about that. Think about holding craving in that way as an add-on, right? And so then what's kind of wild is to, as I was getting at earlier, how to stabilize a mind in which, when it's authentically only what's authentically available to us, a mind that is already happy now, always already happy now. I don't mean gleefully goofy happy. I mean the happiness of these faces. If you look at these faces, they don't all look like people who are having a bummer experience, right? There's a peacefulness, there's a contentment, there's a love, there's a warm-heartedness. That. So, and then we have kind of a paradox, because on the one hand, things are impermanent, right? There's that deep teaching. On the other hand, we are trying to stabilize a different sort of standing wave than the conventional one, which is suffering, right? We're trying to shift the causes to have a different kind of standing wave that's stably different. It's stably at peace. It's stably contented. It's stably loved and loving, right? And as we do that, we undo the causes of craving, right? As you locate an increasingly stable sense of, you know, peacefulness and safety, feeling all right now, just not at war with anything or anyone, you know, unthreatened, like alert, aware of challenges, but not anxious. As you stabilize that more and more, you undo causes of craving related to our need for safety. There's no deficit of safety. There's no disturbance of safety. You might really need to be alert as you drive on the freeway between two big trucks or climb in the mountains on the edge of a cliff, but you're not craving, you're not suffering. Right? Also, as you stabilize more of a sense of personal contentment, gratitude, little smile, a little happiness. Like, we live ridiculously well, and most of the time we don't even notice it. You know, walk through these old castles where the, like, hoi polloi, the Donald Trumps of the time, you know, lived a couple hundred years ago, and you just think, wow, ordinary Joe and Josephine in a trailer court somewhere in Ukiah are living better than King Louis the 14th, day to day, basically, right? And also the more we stabilize that sense of just, you know, people do love me. People do love us. People do care about us. And even if there's not enough caring coming this way, there's a fullness of lovingness in which our own loneliness or hurt or longings arise. You know, there couldn't be the basis for our longings for love if there wasn't some prior basis of lovingness. So as we hang out more, already happy now, there's less basis for craving. In other words, happiness, to finish, I'm good. Happiness is not just the fruit of practice. It's the path. It's the path. It's not just the end. It's the means. This deep, I don't mean this silly, goofy happiness. Oh, well, you know, I'm going to Disneyland. All right, okay, fine, you're happy you're going to Disneyland, but I'm talking about a bone-deep peace, contentment, and love, right? As we help that increasingly stabilize, that's our practice. Isn't that an amazing practice? To take happiness as your practice. Right? Hanging out at the front edge of the standing wave of consciousness. With this feeling that craving is not necessary. It's added to. Do you want to try a little micro-experiential practice? We'll just see if you, just for a second. I think it's really helpful again and again and again to, as I said, I think so much of Buddhist practice is mindfulness of craving and not craving. You know, in increasingly granular, multi-embodied way, right? Increasingly in real time. Mindfulness of craving and not craving with a subtle encouragement to gently help craving fall away, and a subtle encouragement to help not craving, you know, increasingly stabilize while being functional in the world. And that's second, as I discovered that it was my recorder that was beeping. Second, try it with contentment. Just plug in. You're encouraging a falling away of grasping for more. And see what it's like instead to emphasize, you know, right at that front edge of now, a sense of fullness, enoughness, plenitude. It can help to think about some of the many fun things you've done, or think about people or places that make you happy. It's already enough. Contented. What happens to craving when you're contented? A continuity of contentment. You might observe little bubbles of desire arising, like wanting more, and see what happens if in the moment you just remind yourself, oh, I already have plenty. The feeling contentment. And then last, you know, feeling liked enough already, loved enough already, it'd be nice to have more, okay. But, and also feeling your own lovingness. Like whatever they do out there in the world, your lovingness is true. See there too if any kind of, if the centering in your own lovingness and feeling of being cared about by other people, other beings, see if that can help any sort of chasing after approval or upgraded lovers or mates, you know, kind of fall away. Okay, and then just to sum it up, if I were to nominate something for you, it would be to take locating and finding and valuing and protecting and increasingly stabilizing being already happy now is a very fundamental practice. Right at the core of this great matter of helping and enabling craving and thus suffering to fall away. Okay, what do you think about all that? Well, what I think about all that, briefly, is first, It's important to appreciate this is not just neutrality or tranquility, right? Which is useful. But tranquility, neutral, is not enough because right then, you know, our animal inclination is to chase for more. I think neutrality doesn't tend to crowd out craving and clinging, right? Just relaxing doesn't tend to calming alone. Doesn't tend to, you know, equanimity alone doesn't tend to crowd out craving and clinging. There needs to be something, for one, when craving falls away, often there's something joyful and almost elated that arises in its place. Or what a relief, like fear no more, thank God, right? Something positive, emotionally positive moves forward. And also, I think it helps have something emotionally positive that we're not clinging to, but we are gently encouraging the stabilization of. Right? That, yeah. Because I think it takes something where we feel, like I said, that emotionally positive, happy in a single umbrella term that encompasses peace, contentment, and love, to crowd out and undo this biological engine of craving 10,000 times, if not more. So that's one. Yeah.
Well, I love the image of the rock and the water over the rock. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if we're not really awake, we're just going to get slammed into the rock.
All right.
You know?
That's good. Yeah.
And so it's not, it's like you said, it's not about just hanging out. Yeah. It's about having to be really awake at the front edge where it is quite calm.
Yeah.
Until we're not awake, until we're not practicing, and then phew, in we go.
Right. Thank you.
So it's just a great image, I think.
Oh, good. Okay, good. Yeah. Having banged into a few rocks and rivers in my time, I can appreciate that. What do you think of this weird, crazy idea that craving is not necessary, it's added, and that happiness is actually a fundamental practice? And please, even though what you're about to say may have nothing to do with what I just said there.
Well, don't you think sometimes you do need to notice that something reminds you of your mother in order to get past it?
Oh, yeah.
How do you distinguish those?
Yeah. 100% true. 100% true. So, I'm not speaking to trying to push things away or not, you know, reflect on things and establish our own view about them. And, you know, the simulator form, you know, serves a function and all that. What I'm myself, you know, I kind of really interested in being aware of is what's coloring the mind in that moment. And you can just tell, right? I grew up in L.A., smog-filled skies. That was the inner atmosphere of the mind. You know, is your mind smoggy right now? Is it colored with fault-finding or grievance chasing or grievance fueling, right? Rightness. I know that one well. I'm trying to prove your point. Say it in a more clever way. That's what I would say to those talking heads on TV, right? And, right? You know what I mean? Or is it colored by fear that's more than what's appropriate or needed? Yeah. Is it colored by recrimination? That's what I'd say. You know. And that's the kind of, it's like, you know, I think it's like mindfulness of craving, mindfulness of not craving. And then we're doing, a lot of times we're just observing it, and that alone can make a difference. But I think to really stabilize that standing wave of consciousness, given our animal heritages, we can't just witness at all, because it just, those tendencies are very slow to change. I think they take more active effort, you know, in the mind. Right. Including the cultivation of happiness, because, you know, flowers crowd out weeds. Right? More and more as you feel settled and unthreatened, and more as you feel full and contented and, like, loved, just love, then there's less basis for craving. Yeah.
So, Rick, I've been wondering, since you mentioned it, and I think you just alluded to it again, but I'm not sure, about the connection between the hedonic tone setting and the actual extra stuff that we put on it. And isn't it possible that maybe that's a place to catch it if it's unpleasant? I mean, yeah. Could you say more about that?
Yeah. Very often naturally when something's, let's say, unpleasant, mm-hmm. let's say interpersonally, maybe we're worried about something, that's a natural signal to any animal to start, you know, craving the end of what's unpleasant, right? Same with pleasant. We want to, you know, it's pleasant, more, yum, yum, yum. Okay, that's a very normal process. Very often what we do in practice is we try to install a kind of shock absorber in which we're detached from pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, and we're just witnessing it. That's good. That's helpful, right? And also, often after the fact, we notice that after something is pleasant and pleasant, you know, heartfelt or neutral, we're getting caught up in a reaction. So almost like retroactively, we instant replay in our mind in practice. We go, oh yeah, you know, my sister said that thing to me, that word in that email. I was like, God, I got into 15 minutes of ranting about it with my wife. Trust me, I have. And then I go, oh, yet again, I'm doing it. Thank you, mind. Thank you, Obama, right? Thank you, mind. No, right? That's okay. There's a place for that. What I'm talking about is preventing the whole mishigas in the first place by what we're cultivating at the front edge of the standing wave. And if you're cultivating at the front edge an increasingly bone-deep sense of safety and, like, I can handle the unpleasant, it's all right, and peace, you know, and all rightness, then when things that are unpleasant arrive, they land in this big space that is their antidote, right? And if you already just feel lusciously full with life, the next chocolate truffle on your mouth is nice, but it lands on a mouth that's already had like a 12-course meal. Do you see what I'm saying? Because we've already cultivated the contentment. Right? And same with love. You know, things happen and it's like, well, you know, it's like if you already feel, imagine a situation where you're head over heels in love and, you know, your sweetheart has just been amazingly loving towards you and just blown your mind with how much, you know, that being loves you. And then you open up your email or something and you realize that somebody dissed your Facebook post or something, right? Or some stranger on the street looked at you dismissively, frowned and shrugged and turned away. You're like, oh, okay, whatever, man. He loves me. Or, you know, he, she, it, whatever, right? It just lands on something bigger and bigger. That's kind of more and more what I'm talking about. Yeah, and it's not either or, they're all good, but I really encourage you to, as I wrap up here, to play with this practice. It's a joyful practice, it's a beautiful one. Kind of right at the front edge, do I need to crave or cling right now? And instead, could I actually feel, you know, like peaceful and threatened, even if it's unpleasant, in my core, what really matters, you know, being as allness, if it helps to go out to allness, you know, no matter what's happening locally, allness itself is never threatened, right? Or, you know, here I am. Contentment's really a powerful one to cultivate because we're trained to be discontented in our consumer culture, right? To instead cultivate contentment, that's really powerful, right? In love, like that's what I'm really encouraging here, is really a radically powerful practice. It's not about positive thinking. Right, it's about truthness. Anyway, yeah, finishing up, Rob.
I like that practice, and happiness, tranquility, peace, even. Yeah. They're not very popular
in the culture.
In the world.
Yeah. Okay.
And when we practice it, be careful of we.
Sure.
It's a very powerful word.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it brings the arguments of who owns God, and then we kill each other.
Mm.
So, we, I find a dangerous word, because maybe I is a better word, you know, when talking about our practice.
Mm-hmm.
And why can't this notion spread in some secret way that people don't notice, that all of a sudden, after 1,000 years, they are seeking happiness and tranquility, rather than defining the thousands of we's that fight each other.
Yeah.
Because right now,
yeah,
apparently, happiness isn't popular, and it also isn't, obviously, is not required for survival of the species. Or, you know, we'd all be dead. We'd be 100 people on the planet, or 1,000, or 1,000,000, but not 9 billion.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that. I mean, obviously, bow to that perspective. And, you know, where I just go myself, and it is my encouragement to you, is to bring the practice into your own standing wave, right? And there's so many opportunities, many a minute, actually, to observe the habit of discontent arising, or the presumption of problem, right? Or the looking for rejection, right? It arises again and again, and actually there's no basis for it. There I am in my car tonight, it'll happen, I guarantee you, pulling out of the parking lot, driving down, my mind will start moving into the next thing. Very quickly, there will be some presumption of problem, a subtle problem, implicit problem orientation, little bits of anxiety, a drivenness to solve things and fix them and make them permanently fine will start arising in my mind. Right? And in that moment, then there's the question, what's coloring the mind stream, right? Is it a useful, just thinking through, okay, how should I deal with that, and that's actually productive, or is it just the habit of discontent, the presumption of problem? And instead, can there be a, oh, actually now, the leading edge of the standing wave it's all right. It doesn't need to be a doing of that. There can be maybe a little bit of productive thought about that, but otherwise there can be a falling away. That's the practice. And okay. Already happy now. Let's sit for a minute. Happily. And also, obviously, if you chase the happiness, whoop, gone. Squeezed, crunched, squished, right? Or turned into an ideology that we're going to put onto other people. And instead, you know, it's this really trippy thing, how to stabilize certain qualities of the edge of the standing wave without turning it into frozen ice. Because then it's not alive anymore and it's not happy either. I do believe, with deep respect for the words I'm about to use, that in that moment of non-craving, non-clinging, in that moment of, you know, already happy now, that's Buddha mind. Right there. In that moment. And abiding in is Buddha mind. Happy already. See you next week.
Thank you, Rick.
Pleasures.
I have a question.
Oh.
And somebody